The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to a terrifying games takeover of Tech Weekly with me, Keith Stewart, The Guardian's games editor. This week we'll be lighting our torches, checking our ammo and venturing into the nightmarish world of horror video games. Inspired by a resurgence of interest in the genre, we'll talk about the process of creating interactive horror experiences with Dan Pinchbeck, co-founder of award-winning studio The Chinese Room, and I meet the great Sigourney Weaver to discuss her role in translating the iconic Alien film into the world of games.
I think there's a whole new world of using gaming to enter into these stories and experiences for any of us that's going to be incredibly satisfying.
And yes, there will be blood. This is a special Tech Weekly from The Guardian. So before we have a look at the games that are coming out now, I thought we'd have a quick sort of glance back at the history of horror video games. And to help me in this quest through horror history, I'm joined by games journalist and author Lee Alexander, who, like me, is a bit of a horror games fan. Hello, Lee.
Hi, Keith. Thanks for having me.
What do you think have been some of the most important horror games in the history of video games then?
Well, personally, I lend a lot of importance to the horror games in our past that are more abstract and less direct. I think the ones that I grew up on were like the Silent Hill series, the Fatal Frame series, the Resident Evil series. You know, the early Resident Evil games were very much about a sense of dread and exploration, less than they were about conflict and confrontation and running and gunning. And I personally am nostalgic for the days of atmospheric horror where we felt powerless.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, all those games that you've mentioned there, and I did a quick poll on Twitter today to ask my Twitter followers what their favourite games were, and those games all came up, and they all obviously belong to a genre which we now know very well, is called survival horror, which, you know, which Resident Evil brought in, and Resident Evil's creator Shinji Mikami kind of more or less invented. And yeah, the whole auspices behind these games, the whole reasoning is that you're very constricted. It's very claustrophobic. You never have much ammo. You don't have much room to move around. The controls are very weird and imprecise. So it's all about vulnerability and escape and evasion, isn't it? Rather than actually being some sort of gung-ho action hero blasting zombies in the head.
Yeah, I fully agree. And also, I think with many of these horror games, particularly the Japanese survival horror games, the themes would be very mature. I remember playing games that would be about, you know, troubled family dynasties or about, you know, poisonous relationships. And there would be all these, you know, that the horror imagery would be of, you know, mortality and motherhood. It wasn't so much about goring zombies in the head and things like that. It was more social and personal fears that were dealt with through the symbolism of these games. They were always kind of hard to understand and unsettling, and you kind of try to have to figure out what all the imagery you were consuming was all about, and I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you know, when we think about survival horror, I mean, obviously there were horror games before these came out. You can look to games like Alone in the Dark, the 1992 adventure game from Infogrames, and before that you had kind of sort of very superficial horror games like Splatterhouse, the 1988 arcade game.
Yeah. I had Splatterhouse on the TurboGrafx 16.
Oh yeah, was it censored for that? I can't remember.
You know, I can't remember either, but as a kid, I remember finding it, you know, a little bit beyond what I was, you know, used to seeing. These like pink fleshy things everywhere, and it was a little bit terrible and gross. So I'm not sure the extent to which it was censored, but
I think the lead character was kind of a sort of copy of Jason Voorhees from Friday the 13th.
Yes,
wasn't
it? He had a hockey mask and everything.
But it was kind of immature, and although Alone in the Dark was more mature, it was still kind of based around jump shocks, whereas when Resident Evil came in 1996, and it was followed by lots of survival horror games like you've talked about Fatal Frame and the Clock Tower games, they all, and especially Silent Hill as well, they did have these adult themes. And I just wonder, it took a few years, it seems, for developers to have the maturity to really look at the psychological aspect of horror, didn't it? Rather than just filling the screen with blood and gore. It took a while for developers to actually, I guess developers, artists, before they were capable of thinking about horror as something symbolic and indicative of our inner dread and fears, rather than just, here's a monster.
Yeah, well, in general, I think you're right. Broadly, I think there's a big difference between the way people in the West, particularly Americans, approach horror media versus the East. I like to watch horror movies from Japan and Korea, and a lot of them are about the unseen and the unknown. Like, it's, you know, historical ghosts, or, you know, ill spirits, or, you know, it's very subtle and invisible. Whereas I think if you look at the history of film in America and in the West, a lot of the popular horror films are about, you know, the in-your-face serial killer in the backyard type direct interaction. So I don't know so much if it was an issue with the maturity of video games in terms of the themes, but it was, I think, you know, as certain types of console games became popular, the voice of that sort of, you know, that vibe, that approach to a more mature horror was able to sort of come through the games that were on the market from Japan. Mm-hmm. That's sort of my hypothesis. I do this series of Let's Play videos where I go through old computer games from the early 80s. And I did find a horror game that I recently played called The Curse of Crowley Manor. And it was actually really scary. It's a first-person, you know, text-based adventure game. So you know, type to open things or type to look at or speak to things. And there were some things that were frightening about it, thanks to the terseness of the parser and the crudeness of the graphics. And it did try to do things that shook up your expectations of the environment. Like, at one point, there's a hallway where if you do anything else but walk forward, you know, you receive a chilling message. And I don't know, I think horror is something that video games have wanted to look into for a while, and we're still exploring that, and our various cultural influences play a role.
What's interesting as well is that I feel now that there has been a resurgence in horror games, and we've all, obviously one of the things that I'm looking at the moment, I'm actually playing right now, is The Evil Within, which is the new game from Shinji Mikami and his new studio. So the creator of Resident Evil has returned to survival horror, and in lots of ways it's very traditional. But I think what's interesting is that the indie sector has kind of rediscovered horror as a viable and interesting source of material. So we've seen games like Slender, Amnesia.
The Slenderman mythos and things that are sort of built from the disorder of internet culture. And I think Amnesia is one of those as well.
Yeah. And I think, and again, it's about that kind of idiosyncratic approach. So very small studios, sometimes one or two people, are able to sort of really explore horror because they don't have to, they're not worrying about making $30 million and feeding 200 staff. So they can do things that are slightly offbeat.
Yeah. I mean, that being said, you know, I'm very nostalgic for, you know, the older, smaller games. But I think the scariest experience I've had in a video game in so long was I recently went through the PT playable trailer for Silent Hills, basically. Have you played that yet?
I've not seen it, but I've heard about it. This was the big story at Gamescom, and Silent Hill, which we've not seen a lot of recently. The latter few that were released a couple of years ago didn't do as well, and then we suddenly found out that Hideo Kojima, the creator of Metal Gear Solid, is coming back, and he's taken over Silent Hill, and they produced this interactive trailer, PT, which I've heard is terrifying.
It's more than a playable trailer. It's a short game experience with some puzzle elements, and there are some, you know, strange underground conspiracy theories about how to achieve the true ending and unlock the ability to play the actual Silent Hills trailer. Of course, now they have to unlock it because I can't go on the internet and watch the trailer. But the playing through PT was so frightening because it was so vivid, and it sort of made me eat my words in terms of my previous pledges that high resolution and high end and realistic looking video games were not going to be as scary as others. I couldn't get through it. I had to hand it off to a colleague and have him finish it because I was so frightened, even though the only activity in the game is basically moving forward and looking at things. There's no reflexes required necessarily. There are no, you know, it's not a complex interaction that you have to be prepared to undertake when you're playing PT. But, you know, even despite the fact that all I really had to do was walk, I was so terrified. I found it very difficult to handle. And it made me, it renewed my excitement all over again for modern horror games.
So what's in it? Is it like just basically a haunted house where you're going from room to room and experience things? Or is there a kind of a sort of mini narrative happening in there?
There is, you know, I have to, it's such a delicate and a small experience that I have to be careful not to spoil it, but interestingly enough, I think most everyone will have a different experience of it. You know, not the same events that I triggered will not be triggered for everybody. And there are things that I've read about on the internet that can happen in that game that I didn't see when I played it. And we were so frightened of it that we deleted it immediately after playing it, lest the ghost from that game actually appear in our Destiny game. It felt like a thing that could happen. Yeah, that's how intimidating that experience was. I really can't recommend it highly enough. You should really check it out.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I will do. Yeah, although that has slightly terrified me. But I think that's probably the future of horror games. If we kind of end it there, is probably horror games which kind of work out from the way you play, or maybe even question you before you start, and then provide a kind of very subjective horror experience based around what it sort of works out, or your own fears. And Lee, can you tell us a little bit about what you're up to at the moment? You've just released an ebook, haven't you?
Oh yes, change gears. I have written my second ebook that I self-published. It's called Clipping Through, and it is a sort of memoir / study of life and work in video games seen through the lens of the Game Developers Conference earlier this year. And so it's some personal stories about developers that I know, or experiences that I've had, you know, coming up as a young person, and particularly a young woman in games, reflecting on some of that and what I've learned. And I hoped that it would be interesting to readers to provide a sort of up-close look at what it's like to do this kind of work, and what it's like to see the people that I see and know the people that I know. And there's also some editorial views on the industry as well. And it's been selling really well. I'm really grateful to everybody for the support. But if anybody listening would like to check out my book, you can just you can search Lee Alexander Clipping Through. It's on gumroad.com for $5, or pay what you want.
Lee Alexander, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Kingdom is safer than any other. Keep the door shut. Do not go outside the house until you are told it is safe.
And that was a short excerpt from Everybody's Gone to the Rapture, a forthcoming game from the award-winning British studio The Chinese Room. And joining me from that studio is the co-founder, Dan Pinchbeck. Hello, Dan.
Hello there.
To start with, can you tell us a little bit about Everybody's Gone to the Rapture? What's it about? What's the idea?
So it's an open world science fiction mystery game. So it's taking some of the ideas that we had with Dear Esther and Amnesia and Machine for Pigs, and looking at something which is very heavily story driven, very much driven around the player experience and kind of emotional storytelling. And yeah, it's difficult to talk much more about it without giving it away, because the whole thing's the story, that everything you say about it, you just think that's one less thing for the player to find in the world.
So yeah, yeah. Well, we should talk really about your previous games. One of the things that I was just speaking to Lee Alexander about, the history of horror games, and we've said that for a while horror games kind of fell out of fashion because people maybe found the control systems rather archaic with games like Silent Hill and Resident Evil, and it kind of I guess the genre became kind of staid. But then we had obviously the rise of indie developers, and then suddenly we had these amazing idiosyncratic, weird, subjective horror games like Slender and Amnesia, which you obviously produced a sequel for. So would you kind of agree that indie is kind of a natural fit for horror because it's small teams working in kind of offbeat ways?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a kind of quite a brutal economic reality to it, which is as the production costs of big games go up and up and up, then you have to inevitably go for a larger audience to make a return on it. And that's hard to do with horror because actually it is quite a niche kind of subject, but also you're kind of deliberately pushing players into quite uncomfortable places, and that's obviously not necessarily something that hits a particularly wide audience. So if you're working on an indie title, you've got lower overheads, you simply don't need to sell as many copies to kind of break even, which means you can really target a much smaller audience very specifically and kind of really focus on their kind of needs in it, which means that rather than a very large number of people getting a fairly mediocre experience, which is where kind of like AAA horror ended up, you have a smaller number of people having a great experience, and it still works as a business model for developers. They can continue to make things which are really exceptional experiences for the kind of audience sizes that fit it.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Amnesia games? Because you didn't write the first one, but you wrote the sequel. How would you kind of characterize the games? How would you explain them to people that haven't played?
So, I mean, both of them are, I guess, psychological horrors, in that what they're really interested in is not jump scares and it's not kind of grossing people out. It's much more about kind of trying to get under the skin of the player, trying to work with quite sort of deep, disturbing ideas and kind of drive them quite heavily with kind of story. So I think particularly with Dark Descent, it took people completely off guard when it came out, because it was so different from any other horror that had been made, because actually this wasn't something that was all about kind of like making you kind of leap out your skin. But you kind of ended up even more terrified, because Frictional really, really understood that the kind of thing which is so true in kind of horror literature, of actually there's nothing more powerful than the reader or the player's imagination. So the less you actually show and the more you infer, the more frightening it is. And I think both games kind of share that. What we're trying to do is just provoke the player's imagination to start filling in a lot of details that the game might not necessarily present, and kind of relying on the fact that if the player's emotionally invested in the world, they're likely to scare themselves far more than you could ever scare them.
So yeah, if you look at the most successful horror films, they tend to be those kind of teen slasher picks, where it's kind of a group of people locked in a house or exploring some kind of haunted location. And it's their relationships that create the horror, because they'll all go off by themselves, or one of them will think someone else is an enemy suddenly. And it's those relationships. So you feel as though that should be something that games could simulate and explore, the idea of, okay, you're in a haunted house with five of your friends. Well, what if one of your friends turns? How can you trust them? That seems like maybe it's an interesting way of going.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really surprising that more hasn't been done with that idea of kind of like, and they're doing it with Fable Legends at the moment, the asynchronous play, where you're playing with like a dungeon master and a group of players. And again, it seems like something that would be really great to do with the horror, of going, you all think you're having the same experience, but actually each person within the group is being fed information back channel as well, to kind of turn that experience around. So you start getting the group playing off against each other and kind of like turning on each other. There's a whole fantastic kind of scene you could play with there, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So with Rapture, when are we likely to see it? It's always
it's too early to tell at the moment. I mean, it's coming on really, really well. It's a big game for us, so we're being a little bit cagey about release dates, because you never want to kind of, the worst thing you can do is kind of go, yeah, we think it's coming out then, and then you get into that awful thing where you're constantly backpedaling. So yeah, we're just gonna, until we know that we're absolutely kind of on the home straight, we'll kind of just fudge that answer, really.
Dan Pinchbeck from Chinese Room, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Cinema has obviously had a profound effect on the evolution of horror games, and so the translation of the Alien franchise from big screen to consoles has always made sense. Until the arrival of Alien Isolation, however, this landmark of science fiction horror has had a bumpy ride in the gaming world. The 80s saw decent translations of the original movie and Aliens, but the recent Colonial Marines was something of a disaster that many feel should have been nuked from orbit, just to be certain. Developed by Creative Assembly for Sega, Alien Isolation is set 15 years after the events of the first movie, following Ripley's daughter, Amanda, as she travels out to an abandoned space station to discover the fate of her mother. The game is essentially a cat-and-mouse stalk-em-up between the player and one intelligent alien monster, perfectly capturing the unbearable tension of Ridley Scott's original movie. And for extra authenticity, Sega called in members of the original cast, including Sigourney Weaver, to provide voices for a special downloadable mission. I met up with Sigourney in New York a few weeks ago, and started out by asking her if it was a good experience to return to the character of Ripley after so many years.
It was a very interesting experience, quite surprising to me because, you know, it's been a long time since I played Ripley, and I was very surprised that when I opened my mouth, without even thinking, that it was her voice. And it was like she was lying in wait. but I found it actually a very interesting and very moving experience because of what they asked me to do. And I didn't realize that Ripley was still lurking. But I guess at this point, I've done so many of them that she's sort of part of my DNA. And I would say a very cherished part.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, you know.
Yeah, because she's obviously been part of your life for 30 years, hasn't she? So, I mean, was it important to you when you saw the game? Was it important to you to like it before you sort of committed to being involved?
You know, I've been approached a number of times to do, you know, video games, and I, although I love, you know, I'm all for people doing whatever they want, this was different from other things that I've been approached with. This had so much content, so much story, so much character, and was sort of much more emotional. And at the same time, it seemed like it would be a very visceral experience of taking the spectator and, you know, putting you in that world where you have to make the choices. And you do have a flamethrower, which works very well, but you have to listen, and you have to look, and you have to go through that ship on your own. And I think it's going to be wild for people to do that because the film is really held up, and I think it's because of the way Ridley shot it and a lot of reasons, but I think it's, it really takes the material. It's an homage to what he did so brilliantly, but it also takes it in a completely new direction, very creative direction for people.
And did it, I believe that the sections that you're in are kind of closely modelled around the set. So did you recognise it, actually looking in the game, did you recognise the world?
Oh, I mean, it was spooky because I spent so much time in those corridors and in those big, huge hangars and everything. And because they take so long to light and everything, as a young actor, I was just constantly wandering around and thinking, gosh, how great that they built these beautiful sets for the actors, not thinking that it's really for the viewer. But yes, it really took me back. I thought their attention to detail and also to Ridley's humorous, bizarre little touches, you know, the little odd toy and gizmo, etc. They really worked like demons, and it's a real labor of love, and I think it's going to be very satisfying for people in a completely new way.
And looking back, did you feel at the time that this was a film that was going to last, or did you see it as kind of quite a... Because it was very early in your career, wasn't it? You'd only done Annie Hall before as a motion picture. Did you feel at the time this looks like...
You know, I remember when Ridley pulled the sketches out of the sets and the alien itself and the eggs, which were done by Giger, I realized I'd never seen anything like this in a film. And I just thought to myself, I want to be part of that. But we weren't really interested in, you know, in those days, you never thought about creating a franchise or anything. So what we were interested in was taking this very spare script and with a wonderful group of actors, bringing people into space in this very new way. You know, space is a real environment that was, you know, a real working environment with people griping and bitching, and you know, it sort of turned space upside down. It was no longer this sleek Kubrick style, you know, sterile environment or fantastical environment. And I think that's why there's so many innovations. That's why it's held up. But I thought he was doing a great job, but I don't think I could even envision it as a film, because for me as a young actor, being from the theater, I kind of just experienced it as a story, and I didn't really know what to expect when I finally saw it, you know?
I think I read somewhere that you went in with a very kind of theatrical outlook on the film. You used your theatrical experience and tried to bring that into the character much more than sort of cinematic character. And that seems to work because it was a kind of real ensemble piece, wasn't it? With these great people like John Hurt.
It was a great ensemble. And I remember just saying, you know, the only, it sounds so pretentious, but I remember thinking, saying, they're never going to cast me as Henry V. This is my Henry V. Not that I really, you know, read the play with that involved, but I thought, this is my breeches part. And it was just a really exciting experience for me. And I really, it was a hard experience, but I loved the character. But I didn't ever think about it, you know, being sort of a much loved film, you know, 35 years later. But I'm delighted, you know, I'm delighted that it still seems so relevant for people. Science fiction has that possibility because it's still ahead of us, you know. We haven't gotten to that point where we're landing on LV-41 or something, but it will happen.
Yeah, yeah. I think as well, obviously a massively important part of the film was the fact that, you know, it was a woman that survived. And, you know, I believe early on in the script, Ripley was a man.
In the original script that they bought, it was all men. And the one thing that was really in it was the chestburster scene. Mm-hmm. And I think Walter Hill and David Giler, I mean, it wasn't a big feminist statement. They thought no one will ever think that this girl will end up being the hero. And that's why they did it, really just because it was so such a surprise.
Do you, is it interesting to you that the lead character in the film is Ellen's daughter, Amanda, is kind of sort of continuing the lineage of that character as well, isn't it?
No, I thought it was really a wonderful idea, very daring, you know, to pull off. And I found it oddly touching, as someone who played Ripley, the idea, of course, you don't even know she has a daughter. I didn't know I had a daughter until Jim Cameron created one for me. But the idea that never having seen each other again, that Amanda would go into space, follow in her mother's footsteps, was very moving to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is something about the alien, isn't there, that's kind of given it this sort of elemental feel, like there's something kind of weird and almost Freudian about the alien. There's lots of interpretations about what the alien is.
Yeah.
What do you think the alien kind of represents, and what is it that still terrifies people?
Well, I think it's as you look into a future where you're going to go out into space, the idea that there would be such an elegant, unpredictable, indestructible, intelligent force that was basically a killing machine, one thinks, is kind of riveting. You know, you think of all kinds of things when you go into when you think about going to space, but the alien is really an original idea of a monster. And I think I'm very influenced by Ridley's view of the alien, which was that I never saw it except when I was in a scene with it. It's not like I saw the guy playing the alien sitting around drinking tea. So it still has, to me, a very powerful mystique. And I guess what interests me about the alien is I still don't know what it wants. I feel like there's it's not interested in eating me, or it is interested in me sort of for reproduction, but there's much more going on. It's a much more multi-dimensional creature than I think a regular horror film. And it's a species that actually theoretically exists in space, along with, and the implication is there's so many other species like this. And what we as humans, what will we have to deal with these other visitors, you know? What will they be like? And it's not your little green man. It's not Paul, you know? And so I think it's the elegance and the mystery of the alien that, to me, gives it sort of a staying power.
And do you see, would you ever kind of return as you've obviously done the voice acting here for this, do you feel like there's maybe sort of kind of something unresolved in this character that you could sort of revisit and explore again in the future?
Well, I definitely feel it's unresolved because we never actually finished the story, which was sort of my responsibility because I didn't like where the story was going. I'd already tried to kill myself in 3. I didn't like Alien versus Predator. I thought they were demeaning a wonderful sort of story. And I think Jim said it's like, you know, Alien versus, you know, the Wolfman. And so I think for many reasons, I didn't want to pursue it. I wanted to do other things. But I guess story-wise, as a former English major, I feel like, I wish we'd finished the story. I just, it feels incomplete to me. And, you know, I guess I would be, I wish it didn't feel incomplete to me, but it does. I feel like we never finished it. We kind of left it hanging. And there's a way to finish the story that I think would be satisfying to me and the many fans.
There is this kind of really interesting thing that we've all kind of grown up with Alien, and it's almost like for you, it's kind of almost been a relationship movie in some ways, that you and the alien have been sort of staking each other out for all these years. It feels like it's almost in a weird way, it's a kind of a romance, isn't it? A weird, really twisted one.
Yeah, no, I think there is that. There was that from the very first, because, you know, the alien coming out, seeing this pink creature in the closet, Ridley really wanted to go in that direction, that it was drawn to me because I was so different from it. Sort of Beauty and the Beast, I suppose. And I guess because that was such a strong image for me, I've never been able to forget it, that it is so sexual. And what it does is so sexual and sort of nefarious. It's sort of good and bad, and you don't really know what, you know, we don't know much about the alien. So it's still scary to us, which I think is good. It's not overly familiar, even though we've lived with it for 35 years.
Yeah, exactly. It's always been about suggestion, hasn't it?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
What you don't see.
Yeah, yeah. As a, I don't know how interested you are in video games. I know James Cameron was very interested in video games, but you know, as an English major, which I was one as well, are you interested in? I'm really interested in the narrative possibility of video games.
I completely agree with you. I think there's a whole new world, whole bigger world of using gaming to enter into these stories and experiences for any of us. That's going to be incredibly satisfying. And I know my husband directed this play with Alan Rickman that's based, that's they're working on to make a game out of, and I thought, wow, that's so cool, you know, the idea that you'd be able to enter into some of these perhaps famous stories, you know. You could enter into the world of Kublai Khan, you know. I think that sounds fascinating. You could enter the movie of your own mind in some of these pieces of literature. So I think there's such a huge horizon there, and I think there'll many more people, English majors included, will be seduced by this experience because it's unique and very, very exciting.
And is it kind of frustrating to you that, you know, Ripley is still, whenever anyone thinks of strong female characters, always asked about their favourite strong female character, it's all, you know, 9 times out of 10 people will say Ripley. And there hasn't been another character really that's got anywhere close to the how interesting she is and how rounded she is as a character. Is that kind of frustrating for you? I mean, you've played lots of really interesting roles, but is it, you know, just as an actor, is it, do you wish?
Well, I think she's a very unusual character in general, because she's not a big talker. She's one of these people who does rather than says, and I think there's a lot of mystery about her too. I think Zoe Saldana was a wonderful heroine in Avatar, but in this particular genre, that, you know, it's sort of like women are, you know, sometimes given less of a character and more of a sort of physical job to play and little suits and things like that. And so it's less about the character to me. It's less about what's inside. And I think what's inside is what makes characters interesting. It's their grit. It's their, I don't know, things that are harder to talk about than the way they look or, you know. So I'm proud of the fact that people care about Ripley. I do think it's it's too bad that there haven't been more wonderful women heroines in science fiction. I'm sure that will change. But, you know, I have many other people coming up to me about other things that I've done, so I don't feel too lopsided. You know, I feel like I've done some, you know, beloved movies in different genres, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to leapfrog from one genre to another and from big parts to small parts. And I've been able to do what I wanted to do in the theater, but in movies. So I feel very happy. But it's meaningful to me to meet people, especially very talented young people for whom this movie is so important and still very groundbreaking and innovative. And I just worked with Neil Blomkamp, and he loves these movies. And, you know, it's exciting that it's still relevant.
Well, that's all we have for you this week. A huge thanks to Lee Alexander and also our studio guest Dan Pinchbeck, whose game Everybody's Gone to the Rapture is out on PlayStation 4, possibly next year. This week's Tech Weekly was presented by me, Keith Stewart, and produced by Jason Phipps. Remember, for the best gaming and tech news, just go to theguardian.com/technology. Thanks for listening, and of course, we can all rest safely knowing that there's no such thing as ghosts, even though the studio I'm currently in here is said to be haunted by the ghost of a vengeful audio producer. But I'm sure that's all silly mumbo jumbo. Oh, who's that coming to the room? Oh, wait, who are you? What are you doing? Get off me! Get off!
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.